Welcome to the audio version of Trigger Point Doubts. Do muscle knots exist? Exploring controversies about the existence and nature of so-called trigger points and myofascial pain syndrome. The web version of this article is at painscience.com/tpdoubts. Hi, my name is Paul Ingram. I'm a writer and a former massage therapist in Vancouver, Canada. To learn more about me, go to painscience.com/bio. Pain Science is a website about sensible advice for aches, pains, and injuries. I've written hundreds of free articles and several books about common pain problems, readable enough for everyone, but heavily referenced for pros. This article is one of several audio versions of the largest and most popular articles on painscience.com. To see the complete list available, see painscience.com/audio. This version of the Trigger Point Doubts article was recorded in the first half of 2020, but it will be kept up to date over time. I record chapters individually and separately, so if a chapter gets updated, I can re-record just that chapter and recreate the whole thing with the updated section in place. This is a really important feature of the audio version and of painscience.com in general. I try to keep things up to date. It's a moving target, this subject matter. So I'm always adding citations and updating things that have gotten obsolete. But that does make it hard to keep the web version in sync with the audio versions. And I handle that by just re-recording individual chapters as needed. So it was originally recorded in early 2020, but if you're listening to this in 2026, there's a good chance it's fully up to date with any chapters that have been significantly changed since then, re-recorded and inserted. Trigger Point Doubts. Do muscle knots exist? Exploring controversies about the existence and nature of so-called trigger points and myofascial pain syndrome. Trigger points, also known as muscle knots, are an easy problem to like. We're happy to blame our pain on clusters of tiny patches of cramped muscle tissue because it's a powerful mental image that sounds like it feels and suggests an easy cure. Just rub them out. Myofascial pain syndrome, which is basically too many trigger points, is a tempting underdog diagnosis that most doctors are oblivious to. So it's also got a bit of that secret knowledge vibe. And it's a great answer to questions almost everyone asks, sooner or later. Why do I feel so stiff? Why do my muscles ache? Why does my pain go on and on? Trigger points are the god of major gaps in medicine. But the science of trigger points and myofascial pain syndrome is still weak, and has yet to produce a proven way to treat pain. Because it's all a bit half-baked, even after decades in the oven. Some serious, earnest experts have declared their annoyance with dogma and wild speculation about trigger points, and hype and big promises about treatments for them. The primary example of this is a paper by Quintner, Bove, and Cohen called A Critical Evaluation of the Trigger Point Phenomenon from 2015. It is the main example of trigger point skepticism in a peer-reviewed journal, and it is important, but it's also notable that it is the only one. My ebook about trigger points and myofascial pain syndrome is my best-selling product. It's my meal ticket. It literally pays my rent, buys my food, and keeps the lights on. I wrote it because during my 10-year stint as a massage therapist, 2000 to 2010, rest in peace, I got more therapeutic mileage out of the idea of trigger points than any other clinical concept. In my experience, I was able to help more people in that way than any other, by far. Good bang for treatment buck. Or so it seemed. Unfortunately, I don't trust my experience farther than I can throw it these days, thanks to 10 years of learning about cognitive distortions. It's all too possible that I fooled myself. I take it as an article of faith that I misunderstood the meaning of many of my clinical experiences. I was never an overconfident therapist. I was prone to earnest self-deprecation and making a virtue of candid confessions of my limitations. And yet, I wrote an entire book based more or less on my experience. Experiences like the ultimate trigger point treatment anecdote, which I will describe below. I'll wrap up this section with a great Carl Sagan quote. I don't want to believe, I want to know. Before I go any further, I want to emphasize that this is my main doubts article, but I also have two other closely related articles with some important details for keen readers. One of them summarizes the argument about trigger points, the history of who disagrees with who and why, while the other takes a just-the-facts approach to the biological evidence that a trigger point is a lesion in muscle. Both are even dorkier and more focused than this article. They're intended mainly for pro readers, but they are important supplementary reading if you're determined to wrap your head all the way around this topic. You can get to both of those articles from links in the main doubts article, of course, but also by typing in painscience.com/TPS-lesion or -controversy. Bullet points about trigger points. The highlights of my current position on the controversy. There's a lot of article ahead. This is a 12,000-word monster. It needs about an hour to read to yourself and probably 2 or 3 hours for me to read it to you. If you just want to know my official position, these bullet points are really all you need, and they are an extremely careful distillation of many, many years of thinking and writing about this topic. I've probably never funneled so much work into a single short passage, and I may never do so again. The term and concept trigger points has a lot of baggage, like chiropractic's subluxation, but it is still useful as a label for a symptom. The clinical phenomenon is all too real, but still unexplained. There's a lot of hype and BS about trigger points, and way too many professionals now believe in them like religion. The trigger point marketing horse is far ahead of the science cart, and most current methods of trigger point diagnosis and treatment are sketchy. Although trigger point science is half-baked, it's better than many skeptics give it credit for, and it fares well in comparison to some far worse ideas in musculoskeletal medicine. I have moderate science-based confidence in the tiny cramp theory of trigger points. The kerfuffle over the nature of trigger points is a legitimate, ongoing scientific controversy. It is not a closed topic, and it shouldn't be a closed topic. Humble conservative trigger point therapy is justified, but it should be considered and presented to patients as experimental. There is plenty of overlap between decent trigger point therapy and an ordinary, pleasant massage. Intense trigger point therapy, painfully strong massage and dry needling most notably, is overprescribed and risky. Evidence for the efficacy of dry needling is too weak to justify the risks in most cases. Finally, my goal as a writer is to teach people about trigger points, including the skeptical perspective. When folks Google for trigger points, I want them to find my discussion of the controversies, not just the skeptical perspective, and definitely not just the true believer perspective either. The story of my evolution from trigger point student to teacher to skeptic. So once upon a time, I learned about trigger points from my first massage therapy mentor. She was my massage therapist from 1997 to 2000, during my own training to join that profession. As she worked on me, she explained most of what she was doing in terms of trigger points. Back then, it felt like I was getting special access to exotic knowledge. Certainly, it was much more detailed personal instruction in trigger point therapy than any of my classmates were getting. Monkeys do what monkeys see, so of course I became a trigger point therapist. In fact, it mostly defined me as a clinician for the next decade. I wrote a book about it because I'm a writer. If I know things, I write them down. By the mid-2000s, other therapists were learning about trigger point therapy from me, from my book. At that time, I'd yet to hear a whisper of skepticism about trigger points. I didn't hear one discouraging word on this topic until at least 2008. But I had become a skeptic about a lot of other things in those years. I was getting fed up with the many bizarre beliefs and pseudoscientific practices that pollute the profession of massage therapy. Although I had always had some unanswered questions about trigger points, they seemed like they were on scientific bedrock compared to the worst snake oils. things like zero balancing, therapeutic touch, reflexology, ear candling, applied kinesiology, homeopathy, all uncritically embraced and promoted by many massage therapists. By 2010, I was a serious skeptic, well known for both my writings about trigger points and being a prolific debunker. And that is when I finally started to hear discouraging, skeptical words about trigger points. Awkward. A good skeptic looks inwards. So I did. And I realized, painfully, that what I had described for years as the, quote, good hard science, unquote, of trigger points was actually pretty weak sauce. And the clinicians believed it like a religion and were overselling it egregiously. And this overconfidence was partly my fault. Though, in my defense, I had always counseled humility and conservative treatment. Still, it was really quite awkward. Embarrassing, even. And so, I became a skeptic about trigger points, too. Sort of. In 2012, I wrote the first version of this article, in which I addressed the skepticism head-on. I began to revise my book. Disclaimers about the uncertain science of trigger points popped up like weeds all over painscience.com wherever the topic came up. Literally dozens of popular articles. But it was all very inside baseball. My doubts weren't about the existence of a painful problem, but about the biological explanation for it. In other words, it didn't seem all that important to pass on to most of my readers at first. It was mostly just a rather advanced argument for experts. In 2014, John Quintner, Jeffrey Bove, and Milton Cohen published a scathing critique of the idea of trigger points in myofascial pain syndrome in the journal Rheumatology from Oxford, and suddenly everyone started taking sides. Soon, many people I respected, people who had been my allies in other arguments about quackery for years, were loudly agreeing with Quintner et al. And denouncing trigger points in various ways. Those allies all saw the first version of this article, witnessed my diligent introspection, and assumed I was on their team. And yet, I wasn't. Not really. Not quite. In fact, most of the people who ever read the original version of this article seemed to have concluded that I was on their side, regardless of which side that was. The article was actually quite neutral, and many reactions to it were an excellent demonstration of confirmation bias, selective perception. Many, many people overlooked the fact that I hadn't really come to any kind of conclusion. I had merely indulged my doubts and verbosely mulled over a bunch of miscellaneous, wonky details. Facebook became a big deal in this period, with large numbers of influential writers and teachers all constantly participating in public discussions and arguments about all of this, including, routinely, Dr. John Trigger Points Are Bogus Quintner himself. I am personally acquainted with many, if not most, of the dramatis personae, but I remained conspicuously shushed until 2016, except for an occasional show of public respect for the skeptical position. There have now been years of ambiguity and fence-sitting, while the argument has raged around me and gotten more polarized. I never got off the fence, because I kept having experiences like this. The ultimate trigger point treatment anecdote. The world of trigger point therapy rests mainly on the back of anecdotes like these, and not unsettled science. Most massage therapists have stories like this, but this is a particularly good one. The apotheosis of trigger point treatment success stories. During a family visit, my wife's uncle was suffering from a sickening ache on the front of his shoulder, like a toothache in his anterior deltoid. He was a weathered, cheerful former farmer who'd lived hard and wasn't the sort to complain or ask for help, especially from his nephew-in-law, the massage therapist, a profession that probably seemed strange to him. But he was pale with pain, and I'd never seen him so subdued, so he accepted my assistance without much fuss. A quick clinical quiz determined that the problem had been worsening steadily over a few weeks, had driven him to the doctor where it had been chalked up to arthritis. And yet, the pain was off the charts in a joint that is rarely afflicted by arthritis and had been worsening much too quickly for that diagnosis. If this was arthritis, it was an odd example of the breed. He'd also been told that it might be bursitis, a common misdiagnosis that was an even worse fit, and maybe frozen shoulder, yet another poor diagnostic fit. His range of motion was normal despite the discomfort, so the signature symptom of that condition was just missing. I recognized the signs of what I knew as an active muscle knot or trigger point. And honestly, I would probably still call it that today, for lack of a better term. This naming problem will come up again. I recognized the location as being strongly characteristic of a typical pattern of referred pain from the infraspinatus muscle, and one of the more dramatic examples of that odd phenomenon. Poke the shoulder blade in the back, feel it in the deltoid muscle on the front of the shoulder. I prodded the infraspinatus just so, expertly, and sure enough, he responded with surprise. "Yeah, hey, wow, that's it. I can really feel that in the front of my shoulder." So I rubbed the spot with a practiced thumb for all of 5 minutes, and he was cured. Immediate, total, permanent pain relief. The trouble with trusting my experience. I do not entirely dismiss experiences like that just because they're anecdotal, but I have learned to be deeply suspicious of them. They were good enough for me when I was a massage therapist, but I'm not a massage therapist anymore. My career took a strange turn from massage therapy to science journalism, and it has exposed me to countless worrisome examples of seriously flawed clinical reasoning, most of them supported mainly with anecdotes just like that one. You can get the same kind of stories out of any practitioner of rank quackery, such as homeopaths, reflexologists, and faith healers. For centuries, bloodletters told stories like that. Experience is not enough. This is why Mark Crislip has that great quote of his, "The three most dangerous words in medicine are, in my experience." Things are not always what they seem. And the mind is afflicted with many common reasoning errors and illusions. Throughout history, people have believed really goofy things based on experience. It has become my job to study and understand those mistakes. Many of my own beliefs, one by one, have fallen like timber, hacked down by new critical thinking skills. I no longer believe 80% of what I did in my first couple years of selling therapy to people. Trigger point science is a bit half-baked. For years, the introduction to my book on this topic clearly stated that trigger points are good, hard science. How quaint. I was wrong. There is quite a lot of science, and some of it is interesting and good science, generally better than fascia science, for instance. But as a whole, it doesn't add up to much yet. It's mushy, not hard. And so I changed the phrasing of the introduction early in 2012, a few years later than I should have. That's my opinion, but I'm not alone. Here's a good example of a particularly scathing expert opinion. Dr. Fred Wolf, a rheumatologist, calls trigger point science a kind of pseudoscience, cargo cult science, and pseudo-evidence-based medicine, in which the so-called evidence never reaches the level of evidence and assertions, facts, definitions, and beliefs are derived without testing or without adequate scientific basis. That double pseudo is quite the slap. He's saying that trigger point science is even worse than single pseudo-evidence-based medicine, or medicine based on rather low-quality evidence. This is from an articulate expert, one who worked with Travell and Simons directly, and yet he is quite exasperated with the so-called science of trigger points, and by no means is he the only one. A key premise for doubt: pain cannot be in meat. This section starts with a quote from John Ware, a physical therapist of my acquaintance, an articulate guy who's made many comments over the years that I've wanted to quote. Sometimes I do. He says, "Tender spots certainly exist, but it seems the only purpose for insisting that they exist in a muscle is to justify jabbing, poking, squeezing, or otherwise assaulting them with various implements, including needles." The most basic reason for my trigger point doubts is that they may not be what they seem to be. Clearly, they seem to be muscle pain, but it's definitely not confirmed that there's anything wrong with muscle itself. There might be, and there might not be. I'll be returning to this question later. The words muscle pain describe a subjective experience, one that I constantly endure along with millions of other people, but that doesn't mean that muscle is where the trouble is. Pain is an experience generated by the brain, based on pre-conscious processing of many signals, not just dumbly reporting whatever nerve endings detect in the tissue. So what seems to be muscle pain could be more akin to phantom limb pain, a ghostly projection, and not an issue in the tissue. This possibility has the potential to explain quite a bit about the phenomenon of so-called trigger points. Even if there is a tissue issue, it might not be all that important, just the tip of an etiologic iceberg. And I'll close this section with another quote, this one from the quite famous Professor Patrick D. Wall, from the foreword to the book Muscle Pain, or the textbook Muscle Pain. Dr. Wall writes, "Even the clearest localization of pain in one area may in fact be originating from a distant area. The reference of pain implies the existence of convergence of inputs within the spinal cord. This leads to the necessary involvement of central neural circuits in the simplest of peripheral disorders. It also leads to the possibility that the basic disorder is entirely central." The texture of the problem. The sensitive spots that we call trigger points are not clearly associated with any clinical signs, such as tissue hardness. But supposedly they are. Supposedly every trigger point is not only painful, but a tight patch of muscle tissue, a palpable lump or muscle knot. Also supposedly found in a taut band of tissue, which also twitches when provoked. This stuff is dogma. It's taken for granted by most of the world's massage therapists, and it's the main substance of nearly every published definition of trigger points. According to hundreds of thousands of professionals, trigger points are lumps in muscle. But are muscles actually tight or hard where they hurt? Believe it or not, this really is not clear, and this is one of the main ways that the science of trigger points is pretty half-baked. This question could and should have been clearly answered a long time ago, but it truly hasn't been. In a nice little 2010 experiment in the Journal of Pain, the hardness of the trapezius muscle was tested and compared with sensitive points before and after intense exercise. In a dozen healthy patients, the two typical locations for tender points were not just soft, but they were the softest spots in the muscle. The opposite of what most people would expect, and the opposite of what we quote-unquote know from trigger point lore. In general, quote, "a heterogeneous distribution of pressure, pain, sensitivity, and muscle hardness was found." Here's a quick comedy interlude. That's no trigger point. Thanks to reader SKY, her actual initials, for sharing this cringe-inducing tale of low palpatory intelligence, which demonstrates that some therapists who go trigger point hunting might just get fixated on practically any odd lump. Here's the very short story. A massage therapist was giving a massage to a middle-aged man and started working deeply on his upper ribs below his clavicle. She couldn't get the knot relaxed at all and kept working harder and harder until he told her she had found his pacemaker. I am sure that plenty of therapists would not have made that mistake, but unfortunately it doesn't surprise me. For all the talk of magic hands and the much-touted palpatory prowess of massage therapists, this is hardly the only counterexample I've witnessed and heard of. It's just the worst. Bogey at 10 o'clock. Reliability is not everything. Difficulty detecting something doesn't mean it's not there, or that it isn't worth trying. Lots of things worth looking for are hard to find. The process, plagued with inaccuracy and false positives and negatives, like enemy fighters. Signal detection theory started with radar in World War II. There was a painful trade-off that afflicted the technology. You could dial up the sensitivity of radar to be sure of detecting every invading plane, but Then you'd end up scrambling your pilots to defend against invading geese as well. Or you could dial it down to prevent those false alarms, but then you would disastrously miss genuine enemies. That is a hell of a dilemma, and it's as unavoidable as gravity. It crops up everywhere that anyone tries to separate signal from noise, with any attempt to detect anything indirectly. It's the same as the trade-off between diagnostic sensitivity and specificity in medicine. Both are highly desirable, but you tend to get more of one only at the expense of the other. Just replace enemy fighters on radar with tumors in MRI scans, and you see how similar these problems are. Radar operators were diagnosing invading planes, and radiologists are detecting invading pathologies. It's a really cool analogy, as I still love that. I wrote that 10 years ago now, I think, about, and I just dig it. Makes me chuckle. If trigger points are a detectable phenomenon, how hard might it be to detect them? All indirect detection challenges are tricky by nature. Consider this fascinating recent example where researchers discovered that fMRI studies of brain activity frequently find signals, quote-unquote, find signals, quote, when there wasn't really anything happening. Uh-oh. Brain activity signatures are real, but detecting them is, well, difficult doesn't really do it justice. Palpatory pareidolia, dialing up sensitivity. The problem with detecting lumps in muscles is greatly complicated by pareidolia, a proven and common kind of illusion in which we perceive what we want or expect rather than what is real. It literally happens to the best of us. Pareidolia occurs in any situation where humans are trying to interpret unclear signals, and it is always amplified by a clear bias, or financial interest. And it certainly applies to diagnosing anything by feel, palpation. For a much more detailed discussion of this, I have an article called Palpatory Pareidolia and Diagnosis by Touch. This section is just a quick summary of PP as it applies to the question of trigger points. For many massage therapists, trigger points as a palpable entity are accepted dogmatically, and it's the basis for a lucrative career. If a diagnostician expects to feel trigger points, she probably will. If trigger points really are bumpy, palpatory pareidolia will cause a lot of overdiagnosis. It will be one of the main reasons that diagnosis is hard. But what if trigger points are not actually palpable at all? Alas, palpatory pareidolia is all too capable of disguising this fact. Therapists will probably feel them anyway, because they think they should. You might be skeptical about that, but it's actually almost routine for large numbers of perfectly intelligent human beings to suffer from pareidolia-powered misperception. Our brains really are that weird and fallible. Trigger point doubt number two. What if trigger point therapy doesn't work? Even if trigger points are real, it doesn't mean that we know how to fix them, but that's the hope. With all this trigger point therapy out there, it's reasonable for people to assume that it must work, and certainly trigger point therapists believe that it does. We don't need to understand how a treatment works to test if it works. Science can always measure a treatment outcomes, even if it can't explain the weird biology that powers the effects. Changes in pain and function are fairly straightforward things to measure. A good pain-killing benefit can definitely be detected. And so, if trigger point therapy is more than a shot in the dark, then patients should clearly feel better after trigger point therapy. Indeed, any kind of massage should relieve trigger point symptoms because it should have at least some effect on trigger points. While massage that focuses on finding and treating trigger points should produce even more impressive results. And other kinds of treatments that target trigger points, especially dry needling, injections, and stretching, should be supported by promising evidence at least. All of this should be reasonably clear from clinical trials if trigger points are real, and if trigger point therapists are even half right about how to treat them. So, what does the evidence say? Well, almost nothing, unfortunately. Trigger point massage has never been subjected to even one sufficiently rigorous clinical trial. There are only about a dozen studies worth knowing about, and all have serious flaws, and all were conducted by researchers with a high risk of bias. And by the way, the evidence so far, such as it is cited thoroughly in the article and picked over in even more detail in my book. Most report only minor benefits, and a couple are actually blatantly negative despite their positive-sounding conclusions, if you look at the actual data. Only one reports a more robust effect, but it's based on a single measurement taken immediately after treatment, a benefit that could evaporate within seconds, for all we know. The bottom line is clear. The evidence is promising if you're looking at it from the perspective of a trigger point therapist. If you're a skeptic, it looks more like damningly faint praise. And if you don't have a dog in the fight, well, just inconclusive in that case. One of the signature symptoms of quackery is a long-term failure to produce good evidence of efficacy even after many years. Classic examples of this problem include homeopathy and chiropractic. The wheels of science don't always turn quickly, and it can be logistically and economically difficult to get proper studies done. The modern era of Trevelyan trigger point therapy began at least a quarter century ago, launched by credible physicians who strongly declared the need for research. So you'd think it might have gotten off on the right foot, research-wise. And indeed, there is a lot of research. Unfortunately, almost none of it is focused on outcomes, which is the next problem. Another signature symptom of quackery is to endlessly emphasize only basic biology and hypothetical treatment mechanisms instead of treatment outcomes, touting reams of published research about how and why treatment supposedly works before we even know if it actually does. The best current example of this is the fascia fad, but trigger point science is disappointingly similar. There is a lot of trigger point research, but much of it is cryptozoological in character, exaggerating the importance of anecdotes, indistinct footprints, and blurry photos, because more direct and relevant evidence of the monster seems to be perpetually unavailable. So there's suspiciously little of the right kind of evidence, and the clock of history is ticking loudly. At what point does the absence of evidence become damning? At what point do weakly positive results constitute evidence of absence? And are we there yet? My opinion is, the deadline is looming, but we're not there yet. Acupuncture crossed that line about a decade ago, and chiropractic subluxation crossed it 20 years ago, and homeopathy crossed it at least 30 years ago, if not 100. It isn't too late for fascia-inspired therapy to demonstrate efficacy, but I doubt that it will. And trigger point science, I think, is just still in a legit limbo. Just because a bunch of blind men grab onto an elephant and make amusingly different inferences about the nature of the beast doesn't mean that there is no beast. A little perspective. It's actually standard for musculoskeletal medicine to have inadequate evidence, even about far more ordinary things than trigger points. A recent review of muscle strain treatments concluded that evidence was inadequate for any conclusions. Muscle strains, for Christ's sakes. A common, straightforward injury that affects the highest profile athletes in the world, playing sports that involve more resources than small nations. It's well into the 21st century here, and that's what science has to say about muscle strains? So, perhaps it's not surprising that an obscure and hard-to-define problem like trigger points isn't exactly well-studied yet. Bigfoot hunters have already had their chance and failed. Trigger point research is only about a third as old, and it has always been a much trickier scientific question. I wouldn't have given up on Bigfoot in the late 1960s, and I'm not ready to give up on trigger points yet either. I will do the only thing I can, wait for more and better evidence. Trigger point doubt number 3. Location, location, location. I have often been troubled by glaring inconsistencies and loose ends in the classic trigger point text, the Big Red Books, Trevelyan and Simons, and the more recent in general, Blue Book, Muscle Pain, by Menzies and Simons. The most irritating problem is the puzzle of trigger points that seem to exist entirely outside of muscle. How can you have a little pathological contraction in non-contractile tissue? And a quick aside, just to answer a likely question about this, New, the contractility of fascia does not solve this puzzle. Yes, connective tissue is marginally contractile, but the phenomenon is wholly inadequate, too slight, too gradual to plausibly power trigger points of the same character as that which allegedly exist in the bellies of muscles. Okay, moving on after that little sidebar that could not be avoided. So what are they? The red text describes them without even attempting an explanation, and the blue book acknowledges the problem and then refers the reader back to the red. How unsatisfying. The dominant theory of trigger points is that muscle tissue contracts excessively. It generates a lot of metabolic waste products, which poisons the tissue and perpetuates a vicious cycle. Trigger points are, by this definition, found not only in muscles alone, but in the hearts of their bellies, specifically at their motor end plate zones, where nerves meet muscles. Travell and Simons believed this to be the precise scene of the crime, on the basis of a few lines of evidence. Quote, "The critical trigger point abnormality now appears to be a neuromuscular dysfunction at the motor end plate of an extrafusal muscle fiber." Well, a lot depends on that sentence. Although they call it a hypothesis, they used it more like a fact. It is stated repeatedly with considerable confidence in both texts, old and new, and is then used freely as a major premise for other lines of reasoning. If the motor end plate is really where the dysfunctional action is, then that would certainly be an anatomically definite guide to treatment. Motor end plates mark the spot. And indeed, both texts go to some trouble to explain exactly where motor end plates are in various types of muscle, both explaining and showing with a series of nice diagrams. Understanding the location... Oh, sorry, I'm quoting. I have to change my voice for the quote. Understanding the location of motor end plates is important for the clinical diagnosis and management of myofascial trigger points. Since the pathophysiology of trigger points is intimately associated with the end plate, one expects to find trigger points only where there are motor end plates. End plates in nearly all skeletal muscle are located near the middle of each fiber, midway between its attachments. Page 234. So, that's cut and dry. The conscientious reader of the Trigger Point Bibles, old and new, will take home the message that trigger points are in muscle middles. The theory actually requires it. Now, theory meet practice. Trigger points without muscle. As every clinician knows, people seem to have trigger point-like sensitivity and pain anywhere and everywhere, often far from any motor point. Our subjective experience of body pain includes many examples of focal sensitivity to pressure on tissues, particularly tendons and bony outcroppings. Furthermore, these often appear to respond to treatment just like trigger points. There's little functional difference, all without touching a muscle fiber, never mind a motor point. And here's where things get really interesting, because Travell and Simons knew this too. For instance, just one paragraph in Muscle Pain is devoted to the problem, short but precise and clear. Quote, "Non-myofascial trigger points. Trigger points that refer pain may also be observed in what appears to be normal skin, scar tissue, fascia, and ligaments, and the periosteum. The reason for sensitization of nociceptors at these sites needs to be clarified, but must be different from the trigger point mechanism that relates to dysfunctional motor end plates. These non-myofascial trigger points are considered in detail elsewhere." Must be different, they wrote. Well, that is an understatement. The paragraph concludes with an endnote, presumably referring me to a source that considers non-myofascial trigger points, quote, "in detail," close quote. Great, I thought. Maybe something I've missed all these years. Maybe an answer to the puzzle. I flipped eagerly through the references, feeling that pleasant intellectual buzz when one gets to flirting with a revelation. But my heart sank when I arrived at the endnote. A reference to Travell and Simons, which doesn't have any answers either. The big red books acknowledge and describe non-myofascial trigger points in some detail, but this only deepens the chasm. No effort is made to actually account for them or integrate them into their integrated hypothesis of trigger points. So, how big a problem is this? I have two distinct kinds of clinical and personal experiences, which I trust equally well or equally poorly, but equally, and they cannot both be explained by the same conventional wisdom. So something is almost certainly seriously wrong with this picture. But how wrong? There's nothing about the clinical phenomenon of non-myofascial trigger points that means that the conventional wisdom is actually incorrect. To use cryptids as an example again, there could be many distorted and dishonest reports of monsters and real monsters as well. So too, there could be trouble at motor end plates and, insert some other kind of trouble here, in non-muscular tissues. Indeed, one of the main reasons that almost everything about this topic is difficult is that there are probably many overlapping mechanisms for body pain. Nevertheless, it is a hell of a loose end, and I am hardly the first to notice it. Even Dravel and Simons and Menzies noticed it, they just didn't explain it. It must be dealt with sooner or later, one way or another. This is exactly the kind of thing, one of many, that led Dr. John Quintner to criticize the energy crisis hypothesis more than 20 years ago, and propose a different explanation for what trigger point really is, one that did not fall apart when it didn't seem to be coming from inside a muscle. And indeed, he's still promoting that hypothesis today in 2020 and counting. Trigger point doubt number 4. What if there's no lesion? So far, I've been trying to guess about the nature of trigger points based on indirect evidence like diagnostic reliability, treatment efficacy, and inconsistencies in the stories experts tell about trigger points. These are important things, but in the end, they could all be trumped by the presence of a lesion, something identifiably wrong with the tissue. There is no disease without a lesion. Well, there's exceptions to that, but it's a good rule of thumb. If there really is a lesion associated with the clinical phenomenon known as a trigger point, then does it matter if it's hard to feel? Does it matter if treatment is hard? Lots of really horribly real health problems are hard to diagnose and cure. Many of the doubts and concerns discussed so far are a moot point if the lesion question could be answered. If a lesion exists, it is undoubtedly a subtle one, and this is not unusual in medicine and pathology. While it would be genuinely shocking to discover that there really are large, hairy primates skulking in the coastal forests of North America, unconfirmed for decades, it would definitely not be shocking to confirm that, yes, muscle does indeed misbehave in predictable and painful ways at the cellular scale. Biology is vast, and both muscle histology and pain science are still surprisingly primitive. That confirmation has not happened yet, obviously. Before I get into this next passage, there's a couple of technical points to explain so that it makes sense. First, the distinction between inter-rater reliability and intra-rater reliability. Inter is the consistency between different people, and intra is the consistency of assessments by the same person at different times. Obviously, if healthcare professionals can't agree with each other about what's wrong with a patient, that's a problem. It's also a problem if the same person comes up with different assessments at different times of the same person, same thing. This data is going to concern inter-rater reliability and measuring it with Cohen's kappa values, which I will quickly explain. They go from 0 to 1 with fractions in between, so 0.5 is halfway. Back in 1977, a paper by Landis and Koch suggested labels for ranges of kappa values. 0 to 0.2, slight reliability. 0.2 to 0.4, fair reliability, and so on. In increments of 0.2, slight, fair, moderate, substantial. 0.8 to 1 is almost perfect. Those labels were just expert opinion, and they're controversial, and the experts debate them, but they've also been widely cited and used ever since, because they're imprecise enough to be good enough for many purposes. Okay, so that's the technical background. Now for what I have to actually say about those things. Fast forward to 2017 from the last paper we talked about, and another review of nearly the same data by Rathbone. A decade earlier, Lucas et al. And Myberg et al. Had used data from 5 and 9 studies, respectively. This review looked at 6, so they rejected some and added some. They didn't have enough data for meta-analysis of intra-rater reliability. That's the one of the same person at different times. But they did have enough data for inter-rater reliability, which is what we mostly usually care about when we're talking about reliability. They had to estimate an inter-rater reliability with a Kappa score of 0.452, a rather precise estimate with wide error bars too, 0.36 to 0.54. Of the specific criteria that they used to determine the location of trigger points, the most reliable in their data were localized tenderness at 0.68 and pain recognition at 0.57. Now, here's where all that technical preparation pays off, those Kappa scores. Those are actually non-terrible reliability scores. According to those classifications, fair to moderate, even substantial for the best criterion for localized tenderness at 0.68. But the authors of this review, Rathbone et al., concluded that, quote, manual palpation for identification of myofascial trigger points is unreliable. Well, that is technically true. But here's the thing. Diagnosis is hard, and low diagnostic reliability is actually just medical business as usual. Results like this are often cited by skeptics to argue that it's impossible to diagnose trigger points, which is then also often used as a premise for the even more skeptical argument that trigger points don't even exist, at least not as a palpable lesion. Quote, diagnosis is unreliable because there's nothing there to detect, goes the logic, and that carries some weight. But it is hardly the whole story. Just because something is hard to diagnose doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Something every chronic pain expert ought to appreciate and respect. Most attempts to detect pathologies, very, very, very real pathologies, things like tumors, are technically unreliable, falling way short of a score of kappa equals 1.0 perfect agreement. But still much better than kappa zero, which would be coin-flipping agreement. This result for trigger points, if the data can be trusted, is actually it's kind of good and roughly on par with many other common mainstream diagnostic methods. Of course, more reliability would be great. 0.452 is not great reliability, but the same is true for literally hundreds of other well-studied diagnostic challenges in medicine. I mean, what do you expect from something that is fundamentally difficult to feel? If there was nothing to detect, these reliability scores would be way worse. So now you start to see why the evidence might be, as I put it, encouragingly non-negative. Before we give up on diagnosing trigger points by feel, let's ask a radio operator first. From Radar Science, we learn that reliability isn't everything.